So let's look a bit at this heart practice of equanimity. The Buddhist monk Bhikkhu Bodhi describes it as stability in the face of the fluctuations of worldly fortune, unevenness and unshakable freedom of mind, at a state of inner poise that cannot be upset by pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, or fame and ill repute. So this state of mind is a sought after one, right, across the contemplative tradition. The Buddha said in his teachings, touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. And the teacher Amit Ray calls equanimity the hallmark of spirituality, neither chasing nor avoiding, but just being in the middle. So there's this Buddhist saying that even if the sun were to rise from the west, the Bodhisattva, the follower of the Buddha, has only one way. So even if the sun were to rise from the west, the Bodhisattva has only one way. Our national treasure meditation teacher, Sharon Salzberg, kind of has offered equanimity practice with these instructions of to sit like a mountain, sit with a sense of strength and dignity, be steadfast, be majestic, be natural, and at ease in awareness. No matter how many winds are blowing, no matter how many clouds are swirling, no matter how many lions are prowling, be intimate with everything. And we know this is a useful aspiration, right? Because our unfiltered and kind of unmodulated experience is naturally turbulent and constantly changing in response to external triggers. And we're wired this way, right? We know this, just ready to respond rapidly to perceived benefits and threats of any given situation, kind of in the ways that our reflexes suggest are the most likely to result in survival. So this has been adaptive for our species. We're still here. And it also supports this reactive kind of quality of being that's chaotic and lacking in perspective. And the movement is towards kind of this predisposition to oscillate becoming more and more difficult to resist. Probably familiar with some of the growing scientific and cultural inquiry and discussion into our vanishing attention spans and the sort of just ever increasing distractibility. I can definitely attest to this being part of my experience, has been attributed among other factors and most sort of dramatically to the rise of the internet and the speed with which it presents, you know, this onslaught of shifting information that's specifically designed by the tech industry to capture our attention just long enough, you know, for us to click or like or buy or accept cookies or whatever it is before then kind of moving us along to the next kind of fragmentary content. There's a pretty interesting book called Stolen Focus by sociologist Johann Hari. And he says, we think our inability to focus is a personal failing. It is not. This has been done to us by powerful external forces. Our focus has been stolen. Today at my son's school, there was a shooting threat. and not much was being divulged by the school principal or district. And so parents were, you know, sort of flooding onto the social media platforms to try to get some clarification and support. And I found myself spending a lot of time, you know, sort of hopping from one post to another and looking at my phone and then putting it down and looking at it again. So this is, I thought I sort of noted once that I, we were all informed that the danger was addressed, kind of that I was living this sort of stolen focus very vividly. There's a local artist and writer, Jenny O'Dell, who wrote How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And she says, nothing is harder to do these days than nothing. But in a world where our value is determined by 24/7 productivity, doing nothing may be our most important form of resistance. So the way that she's presenting it, right, our attention is the most valuable resource and tool that we have. And as meditators and practitioners, we certainly endeavor to walk that walk through our practice. So if we can only kind of start to develop a newer, sort of wisdom-informed kind of attention, you know, than we've been conditioned to develop, we might imagine sort of more innovative possibilities for political action, for protecting our planet, or for kind of envisioning and redefining kind of prevailing sort of understandings of happiness and progress. And so this is an important point to make that equanimity is not apathy, right? It's not detachment. It's seeing clearly and then acting from this position of being seated as a mountain with stability and steadfastness. So kind of getting into that piece around how the cultivation of equanimity is not just for our personal well-being, but for our prospects as a species. And one of kind of my favorite wonderful teachers is Kyra Jewel Lingo. And she has written, We Were Made for These Times, which is her reflection on kind of how meditative practice can support us in approaching and relating to the challenges that we are facing, that we're also aware of these days. So she kind of puts out there that, you know, consider the wheel of the Dharma. So kind of esoteric, but we'll get there without kind of going into too much sort of into the weeds of it. But the wheel of the Dharma, sort of a visual representation of the Buddha's teaching. And the wheel has 8 spokes. And sort of the most prevailing understanding of this is that these spokes represent the Noble Eightfold Path, what's called the Noble Eightfold Path. And these are kind of a roadmap for living a balanced and wise and loving life. And, you know, kind of right understanding and right thought and speech and right action and right livelihood and so forth. All of these pursuits that will help us to support our equanimity. And she kind of puts out there, well, they also, there's another sort of 8, list of 8 among, you know, the many lists that the Buddha liked to create, which are the 8 worldly winds. And we talked about that a bit, I think, before in another class. And these are praise and blame and pleasure and pain, gain and loss, and fame and ill repute. So here's the wheel with the spokes. And in the center of the wheel, there's, you know, the circle, the hub, And often in the wheel of the Dharma and images of it or models of it, it's represented as an open space. And so she kind of offers that that space is where we can take refuge while we learn to develop more clear seeing and non-reactive presence through our meditative practice. I think we're all kind of aware of the power of the circle as a universal kind of symbol across many different wisdom traditions, right? You know, we have the cycle of life. We have the halo, you know, of the Christian saint. We have kind of this full moon of awakening in Buddhism. We have the mandala, Stonehenge, you know, the wedding ring, and, you know, the labyrinth, like the beautiful labyrinth at Unity. And so, like the womb, the circle kind of is understood to hold and contain energy so that growth and transformation can occur within the circle, inside the circle. So some of you may be familiar with the saying or the quite wise offering of the 20th century psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who was no stranger to suffering, having been a Holocaust survivor. He said that between the stimulus and the response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. So again, kind of the notion of a circle, a space, or a clearing within which growth and freedom can take root. And as a result of this, kind of the equanimity that we are developing inside this space then kind of has this natural momentum of rippling outward, you know, like the pebble tossed in a pond. And as it does, kind of a cumulative potential possibility to kind of tip us ever more toward needed change in our own lives and in this world. So kind of holding this notion of a clearing that is safe for us to kind of grow in wisdom and in stability. There's the poet Martha Postlethwaite, and she sort of offers simple advice about how to start doing this in the clearing. Do not try to serve the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is yours alone to sing falls into your open, cupped hands and you recognize it and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to the world so worthy of rescue.